as you're thinking about how you're going to use AI to improve productivity and outcomes, I would say like the bare minimum is understand how it's embedded in your sales tools process and stack, and make it easy and fast for your sellers to use and get comfortable with, and they will see value. And for me, this is just the tip of the iceberg.
Well, hello, everyone. I am so thrilled to be joined by Kimberly Dieter for this episode of Go-to-Market Mavericks. Kimberly is the kind of revenue and customer leader that, you know, I hear about before I ever meet her because people talk about how incredible she is as a leader and as a sales leader. And so, Kimberly, thank you so much for joining us. And we're super excited to learn more about you, your career, how you think about sales leadership at organizations like HubSpot, where you are the SVP of sales. And all of the top of mind go to market topics du jour as we look ahead to 2025.
So wonderful to be here, Linda, and such a great pleasure to meet you as well.
I had to do some snooping on LinkedIn when I knew we were chatting, and again, your reputation precedes you. And I always, you know, study incredible leaders that I want to emulate and be like. And in looking at your career, it's really clear that your trajectory wasn't always a linear path. You started your career as a sales rep, but you've also taken on such a diverse variety of roles, from marketing to sales recruiting and staffing to CEO, and of course, most recently, sales leadership as a VP at LinkedIn and SVP now at HubSpot. Can you tell us a little bit more about your personal career North Star? Because looking at your background, it's not immediately obvious, you know, you would have ended up where you are today.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. I was fortunate enough right after college to be spending time with a good friend's family, and her father had explained to me his career path, which was he was an executive at Eli Lilly, and in order to go into leadership, you had to do a rotation through at least four of the disciplines within the organization. So sales and marketing, HR and recruiting, operations, and or product, and one other discipline. And so as I was thinking about my career journey, starting out in sales seemed like the right place. Really required more effort than experience. And then from there, what I was attempting to do was get experience in as many different disciplines as possible. And Paychex was an amazing place where they allowed me to identify problems, create roles, and then step into those for a period of time. When I left Paychex, it was because I felt at that point I really needed to either go get an MBA or at least create an experienced path that would allow me to learn the things that you would learn in that type of program. And so I call it my street MBA. I left Paychex and had an opportunity to raise a Series A as an operator for a startup in Chicago. And from there, you know, jumped into LinkedIn and now HubSpot. So I was very fortunate that people would give me an opportunity to try roles that, you know, maybe I didn't have the traditional background for, but was willing to learn and work hard. And that's how I'm where I'm at today.
That's incredible. And a story that I personally can relate to a lot as someone who also, you know, don't have a very linear kind of trajectory in my career. I'm curious, one of the things that you mentioned really stands out to me, which is you were able to kind of identify opportunity and then almost create, you know, from scratch, a new program or a new initiative, and as a result, a new role for yourself to kind of jump into an uncomfortable experience where you may not have had, you know, you haven't done that exact thing before. Tell us more about, you know, this amazing intuition of kind of identifying those opportunities or those gaps.
Yeah, thank you. I love problem solving. And so I think one of the opportunities at Paychex was based on the fact that I saw a very clear problem in the business. And that's that our sales leaders were responsible for doing all of the recruiting and sourcing of candidates. Now, prior to Paychex, I had been a recruiter for some time. And so I did have a bit of experience there. And so I actually had qualified for a President's Club trip. I was having a conversation with one of our VPs at the time and had shared with him that just some back of the napkin math had demonstrated that we would be better off sourcing internally with a recruiting team for sales positions. And so, you know, they gave me an opportunity or an at-bat to help build out that program inside of Paychex. But I think what happened at that moment was just a mindset shift for me, which is, we're often asked, what do you want to do next at a company? And so people are thinking about, well, what roles are available? What roles are open? What roles have I seen other people step into in order to create career progression? And at that moment, I started thinking about it as, what problem do I want to solve in the company next, as opposed to what traditional role do I want to take? And I think that opened some doors for me because it was an unusual way to think about my career trajectory. And so I challenge people today. You know, I was actually having a call with one of my leaders and we were talking about her career trajectory. And I just said, what problem do you want to solve? What do you think is the biggest problem that we have today? And are you uniquely positioned based on your experience or front row seat to that problem to help us solve it? You know, that should be your next career path, not a traditional step just based on, you know, title or what you've seen in the past.
Wow, that's so nuanced, but also so insightful, because I think, you know, as people leaders or any manager out there, you get asked a lot about, you know, your gung-ho and really successful and ambitious direct reports wanting more opportunity. And sometimes it is around a more sort of, hey, like, this is what I think my personal, you know, ambitions are, versus thinking like an owner, putting yourself into the seat of, you know, owning the business and identifying those gaps in the business. I think that's an incredible piece of feedback, not only for individuals looking to advance their career, but also for owners and leaders to think about what progression really means. I think that what you just mentioned around looking for gaps in the business, really being, you know, willing and capable to go and solve it from first principles, is a pattern that I see over and over again in incredible leaders when I ask them about, you know, how they got to where they are. So thank you for sharing that with us. I guess, like, when you think about kind of, you know, your role now at HubSpot, where you are the SVP and President of the Americas, tell us about, you know, what led you to join HubSpot, what was compelling about the business or your mandate, and then kind of how did you think about impact in those first 60, 90, 180 days that you're there?
It's interesting. When I think about my time at LinkedIn, I don't know that I had ever thought about ever leaving LinkedIn. It's an amazing place to work and really just had been such a wonderful experience for me. So the HubSpot opportunity kind of caught even me by surprise. We had announced a partnership with HubSpot, and I started doing more research on the company. And what I realized is that the more time I was spending with CROs at LinkedIn, every single CRO I spoke to really was pretty unhappy with their CRM. And as I was learning more about HubSpot, every time I spoke to a customer of either Marketing Hub or, you know, HubSpot's Sales Hub or HubSpot CRM, full stop, loved it. And not just was like happy with it, I mean, loved it, like would not stop talking to me about their experience. And so as I started to learn more about the product, I got really interested because, as a sales leader, if you can work for a company where the product does what it says it's going to do and drives immense value for their customers, like, that's half the battle, right? And so the closer I got to HubSpot as a partner, the more I was invested in what they were building and doing. And the more people I met in the organization, I just fell in love with it, honestly. And I think what HubSpot does differently is they're focused on, you know, user value first, which, you know, if your employees love using a tool, you don't have to worry about adoption or a usage gap. And then all the other value is represented through just that usage alone. And so for me, it was a no-brainer when they came to me and said, is this, you know, an opportunity you would consider? It's just been a dream role. And I'm about on my 1 year anniversary here. And I'll say that this year has been so insightful. And I've learned so much just by coming on board with the organization, because it absolutely is a rocket ship for growth. And really that growth is about helping our customers grow, which has just been great.
Yeah, that's incredible. I think every organization says, you know, they have a core value around customer centricity, but living it and proving it out and making sure it's ingrained in the decision-making of the organization day in and day out is a lot harder than, you know, I think it sounds.
That's true. And sorry, you had also asked me about, you know, the first, you know, 30, 60, 90 days here. So I can answer that as well.
Yeah.
I think anyone stepping into an organization, your primary objective should be to build trust. Because if you don't invest the time in building the trust, any change you try and make at a later date, you're not going to be able to move the organization through that change, correct? And so for me, really understanding how you build trust is key. And so I think new leaders intend to build trust, but they jump in and move quickly, and they want to build credibility through demonstrating their expertise as opposed to listening and learning. And I know it sounds quite simple, but I often share with folks that, you know, there's three C's in trust, which is curiosity, care, and commitment. And if you fail to represent one of those three, you'll fail to build trust. And so when I came into the organization, that was my primary objective, not to demonstrate, you know, what I knew or my expertise per se, but to really learn from those who have been here, demonstrate my commitment to the organization by building, you know, a long-term plan and strategy, and really demonstrate how excited I am to be part of this organization through that care piece too.
Yeah, that's, you know, I think we've all been part of organizations where we may roll our eyes at the new change agent that's come in who, you know, care more about demonstrating ASAP than listening and learning. So, you know, it sounds like your organization is super lucky to have you at the helm. At the same time, you know you are brought in to affect change. And so how do you kind of identify those, again, going back to that concept of those pockets of opportunity, right? Those areas that you seem like you can really just hone in on and say, hey, like through, I imagine, a mix of intuition and data and listening and, you know, qualitative stories, you're able to really pinpoint, you know, where you need to focus in and make some fast, high quality decisions. How do you do that? What's your secret sauce?
I don't know if it's any secret. I think most people probably know this, but I'm looking for patterns across the organization. So I would say in my first 90 days, my primary focus was to listen and learn, and not just my direct reports, but cross-functionals. I even build two, I'll say, advisory groups. One is rep and one is frontline managers, so that I can get close to them as quickly as possible to, you know, hear and learn from them, right? I think the best way to learn in a new organization is to shadow as well. So I asked for a recommendation of our top reps for each of our product lines, and I shadowed them on calls. I had them pitch me. I listened to gong calls and recorded looms. And I followed the patterns, right? So making a short list based on what I was hearing and then evaluating and confirming that those were areas of opportunities through data allowed me to make higher quality, fast decisions about where we needed to focus as a team. And the first thing that jumped out to me is that we had, you know, I have an amazing leadership team, but they were working in silos. And so it was an opportunity to create alignment for each of my leaders so that we could move and operate together. That does two things. One, it allows you to scale. And two, if there are, you know, issues, it allows you to pinpoint where that gap is more quickly because it's consistent across the business. And when you're leading teams from Canada to LATAM, it's important to have that, you know, process alignment. And then the second piece of that is, it allows you to use resources more effectively, because if we're all, you know, running the same enablement program, if we're all running the same go-to-market motion, if we're all using the same tools, we can align those resources effectively. So that's been, you know, I'll say like the primary focus in this first 11 months.
Amazing. Yeah. So when you think about kind of the arrows that you have, it's really people, process, and, you know, you always say programs, the three P's. So yep. It sounds like very quickly, you know, you were able to identify some inconsistencies around process where there's a lot of synergies if you simply kind of aligned everybody along the same processes that, you know, were relevant to that process. I'm curious, like when it comes to things like people and, you know, you've spent a lot of time in sales staffing, were there certain philosophical, you know, evolutions in the team that you wanted to build, the DNA of the people? Were there programs that you were like, hey, this doesn't really exist, but, you know, I think that we would really do well if we spun these up?
Yeah. DNA, no. I mean, the HubSpot team is really amazing and strong. I would say from a process perspective, you know, an opportunity to align something as simply as recognition is really important. I think each leader has a way of recognizing their employees for slightly different things. When it's inconsistent, though, across the organization, what happens is people focus on the have and have not. So, gosh, you know, when I'm 110%, my leader takes me out to dinner, where someone else is like, gosh, when I'm 125%, I get a gift card. Or, you know, on my first day, my leader took me to lunch and someone else is like, well, gosh, my leader hasn't taken me to lunch yet. Those things are positive and they're important when you're leading a people organization. But if it's inconsistent, people are pointing at the haves and have nots. And I think that that creates more disruption than good. So we have a fully aligned recognition committee. The team uses similar language, the same bar, and we're working to make sure that the program is consistent as we step into our next fiscal year. So that's a small piece of it, but I think important and sometimes overlooked. When you have an organization that's relatively large, you know, people are doing the right thing by driving recognition, but sometimes the variations across the organization based on segment or leader can really draw attention to the things that aren't consistent.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because I think in a high pressure environment where, you know, the plans are always audacious and the goals are, you know, always stretchy, it's really important to remember how much of a lever it can be for, you know, leading with inspiration and motivation and that carrot effect, right? Of, you know, what people want to strive for versus, I think a lot of times when you talk about process improvements, it can feel like a more punitive thing, right? Like there's some hammer coming in to enforce things. And so I love that example, and I think it's a great reminder to think about that. So we talked a little bit about how you identified opportunities within your organization around process improvements and alignment. How did you think about identifying new areas of opportunity for HubSpot as a business?
It's a great question. First of all, the growth opportunities are immense, which is so exciting. But I think there was, you know, energy during, I'll say, 2021, 22, where people were saying, gosh, like tech first adopters, this should be our market. This is where we should go sell as much product to as possible. And what I think we missed in that motion was focusing on industries that might be going through digital transformation now. So this focus on tech was good, but now we're running into a point where we're saying, where are we growing next? And when I say we, I don't just mean HubSpot. I mean, you know, SaaS sales in general. So I think it's really interesting to look at companies and industries that are going through digital transformation now. So maybe they weren't first movers, but they are moving in rapid rates today. So one example would be manufacturing. So I think if you were going for a sales strategy or approach where you're like, we're going to go after everything in this market, you should step back and say, you know, where has there been a full penetration for our industry focus? And where have we not touched yet? And is this an industry that could be impacted by the decisions that we're making? And so I would say for us looking at it from a precision perspective makes sense. It's easy too if you take a look to say where are your customers or industries that are seeing value And then for me, I have an amazing marketing partner. We said, gosh, we're hearing a lot of success stories from our customers that are in the manufacturing industry. Let's take a look at that opportunity. Let's really evaluate if this is a good fit for us. And then let's make sure that we're driving programs to educate and communicate the value of our products and services to that specific industry. I think on the flip side, there's markets that I think some companies haven't really invested in yet or focused on. I just got back from Mexico City. It was an amazing experience. And I would say, you know, what an unbelievable opportunity to go and grow with a market like Mexico. And so if you're, you know, looking at your lead list and you're saying, gosh, our TAM is shrinking, might be an opportunity for you to say, okay, let's pick a handful of customers that are in specific industries and see if they're seeing value. And then let's actually take a look at markets that maybe we haven't invested in the past. And I don't think that either of these are revolutionary ideas. I just think it's a matter of revisiting things that have worked, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago and saying maybe all of our growth isn't in the tech space. It's in more traditional industries and locations.
Yeah. I think there's an inherent almost uncomfortableness, which is, you know, going back to that pattern of jumping into opportunities where, you know, you haven't done them before, it's brand new, and kind of seizing it, you know, by the horns. You know, I could imagine for an organization that's been consistently kind of focused on this tech ICP, jumping into manufacturing or jumping into a new geo can seem really daunting, right? You talk about the lead list shrinking. It's like, how do I even go get the right lead list for an industry where, you know, we historically don't have as many connections? And so in talking about the how, let's take manufacturing as an example. How do you think about, you know, incentives or people or programs or process where you're like, let's go and experiment or let's go really focus on this? Knowing that, you know, the rest of the organization may not have necessarily all the know-how to understand, you know, that industry or segment yet.
I love learning. So I think anytime I have an opportunity to learn something new about an industry or geo or product, I'm all in. And I think it's important to have people on your team that are also eager to learn. The great news is the market is chock full of industry experts that really know and are willing to show you the way. Like I mentioned earlier, I think if you start with your customers that are seeing value from the products and services that you're selling, they become the blueprint from where you go and grow. And also most industry verticals are highly connected. So if you, you know, I have a good friend who's in manufacturing here in Tennessee. You know, if I go to him and say, hey, here's a value proposition, let's talk about HubSpot, and he sees value, is there easy to go back and say, hey, who else do you know in the manufacturing industry that, you know, you think would also benefit? And by the way, that's actually a real story. My friend who owns a manufacturing company here in Tennessee, as soon as I started with HubSpot, I shared with him what we do. And within a month, he was using HubSpot. He sees that's value. Amazing. He tells other manufacturing professionals and all of a sudden you go and grow. I know I'm making it seem way easier than it is. But I would say start with your customers in industries that are seeing value. They might not be the primary industry you serve, but they could be the second or third or maybe even the fifth or 10th. And this isn't a HubSpot specific initiative. I think this works in any company and also something I think we've done at, you know, LinkedIn. Well, I did before I came to LinkedIn. It's just creating focus, which I think allows your sellers to see better benefits and greater outcomes.
Yeah, I love the focus, the orientation of, you know, start with the customer, let them lead the way. And I also love that, you know, I think we say in sales a lot, leading from the front, the way in which you really go deep, you're, you know, having those conversations, you're flying to those geos and having boots on the ground. I think that clearly makes a big difference in your ability to gather those data, to identify those patterns, to validate them. And then again, to, you know, make those fast, great decisions. So thank you for sharing more about that. All right, switching gears a little bit. We talk to incredible go-to-market teams, CMOs, CROs every day, mostly within kind of B2B SaaS. And a question that we're getting a lot, given kind of the changes in our economy over the last few years, Is it my product? Is it my go-to-market team? Or is it the macro? As a leader who, you know, obviously is responsible for the sales organization, but is so tied in, you know, our success in sales is so tied in with our customers and the macro, but also our product and the innovation that's happening there. And you mentioned one of the core reasons why you were so attracted to HubSpot was that initial validation of this is an incredible product with tons of, you know, increasing innovation and customers that love it. Are you ever confronted at the leadership level with questions like this? How do you think about answering it?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things there. I think any company that's seeing or finding it challenging to grow right now, I think that's really the first question that you have to answer for yourself, which is, does our product provide value? And I would, you know, start with your customer base. I try and put the customer at the center of everything I'm doing. And so if I sit down with my customers and say, help me understand if you're seeing value, and not just at the decision maker level, but also at the user value. How are you measuring that value? How often are you measuring it? And if the answer is yes, this is how we're seeing value, we're good on the product piece, right? If it's a, you know, opportunity perspective, I'm going to go back to my sales strategy team. Or if I'm a small business owner, I'm going to look at the prospecting list that I'm targeting and say, do they mirror the customers that are already seeing value? And have I created an opportunity for outreach, right? Do they know about my company? Do they know the value that I present? And then the third, and of course, you know, we start there often in sales leadership, but I take a business leader perspective. I'm going to look at my team and I'm going to go through, it sounds so silly, but sales math. I'm going to make sure that I'm looking at the ASP and win rates of my reps, and I'm going to look at their targets, and I'm going to reverse engineer it to make sure that they're doing enough activity on the front end to deliver an outcome. And as silly as that sounds, I know so many early in career sellers that have never just sat down to say, hey, what's my average sales price? What's my average win rate? And what does that mean for how many calls I need to make, how many meetings I need to have per week in order to get myself in this position? It's almost more of a, you know, well, I'm going to try and sell everything that's sitting in front of me and I'll probably get there. It's like a law of averages, when in reality, you know, sales math is just that. It's creating a strategy based on your likeliness to close and how much revenue you're selling and then working it backwards. So I know those are like very small and tactical, but that would be the quick back of the napkin I would probably do if I was to evaluate a company and have to, you know, give quick feedback on where the gaps might be and why they're struggling.
Yeah, I love the kind of tip here to focus on identifying those input metrics across, you know, each of these buckets, whether it's product or go to market, and then making sure that, you know, you have a concept of what good looks like or where you want to be. On the sales rep math, we actually found it a big unlock to start asking reps and interview processes with us, hey, how do you know you're going to hit your number, right? And seeing if they think about these kind of more, like, are they conscious and observant of the business? Like, do they understand things like ASP or ACV? And are they actually thinking about their own pipe and their own book of business in a strategic way, right? Because to your point, it's not difficult math. But if a rep isn't thinking about that math every day, then how are we supposed to have confidence that, you know, that individual is thinking about their number?
Yeah. And it all goes back to doing that. You know, being a strong seller is about, in my opinion, someone who's curious about solving problems for their customers. On the flip side, it's also someone who knows how much activity they need to do in order to deliver an outcome.
Absolutely.
So if they don't have one or the other, they're probably going to struggle and roll.
Have you seen the sort of desired qualities of a great rep changing over time as like technology shifts? I mean, I think this is pertinent to the discussions top of mind for folks around, is AI going to completely replace, you know, all of us and humans in a sales process? And, you know, I think my personal philosophy is people will always buy from people, that it is an inherently human interaction that is built on trust and consultation. But you know, I might be a Luddite here and, you know, who knows, in 10 years, maybe we're all bots. So yeah, has your idea of the perfect rep and what qualities they need to have or what actions they need to take, has that shifted in the time that you've been in sales?
Yeah, I think to a degree, I do agree with you. I think people want to buy from someone they trust. That's why oftentimes buyers will do enough research to get to a point, and then they're looking for validation or social proof from people who have already experienced that product or service, or they're looking for a subject matter expert who can just go that one level deeper. And so I think the role of a seller has actually become more complex because they have to be a subject matter expert in all of the products and services and or industries that are associated with what they're representing. They couldn't in the past, because consumers can go and do all the research on the front end, they were more likely to trust the surface level overview of the seller. Well, now they did that surface level overview, and now they're expecting you to go one level, two level, three levels deeper on what you're solutioning. I think on the flip side, there's like a gift and curse with technology. It was much faster and simpler like 1,000 years ago when I was a sales rep, when I just had a, you know, notebook with all my prospects in it and a Rolodex, and I was just dialing for dollars. You know, there were no productivity constraints with the actions I took because they were very simple. Today, you see sellers, and I often refer to it as tool fatigue. Sellers and most employees are toggling between multiple systems, which actually is slowing them down, which means they have to be more thoughtful of the actions and activities they take because they're like, I'm over here, then over here, then over here. And it is a requirement that they know more about their prospects. So you see sellers required to do more research in order to be successful. And so in a way, we've almost like slowed down to speed up, and it's more about quality than quantity. And so I do think there's an evolution, but I don't think it's a revolution. Like, I think it's, things will change and evolve over time, but I don't think it will be in a point in which salespeople won't be required because, you know, the products they're selling will become more complex and people will be looking for more handholding at the back end of the sales process.
Yeah. Over and over again, one of the number one pains that we hear from, you know, revenue leaders who are our customers is they'll say, hey, we did a poll and the sales reps are saying they spend 75% of their week, you know, jumping between different tools, trying to cobble together that unified view of their prospect so that they can even start to prioritize their day, whether it's, you know, prioritizing which accounts they go after or which contacts they want to reach out to. And I think, to your point, it's a blessing and a curse because there's more digital breadcrumbs than ever before, right? There's more digital like front doors between your product or your brand and the prospect universe or the buyer universe. And I think technology can play a really incredible role in either making that easier for reps, more automated, more actionable, more intelligent, or more prescriptive. Or I think the transition point we're in now is there's been pretty much a decade of point solutions that, you know, have arose and been kind of that the tool of the day. RevOps team have been asked to kind of stitch all these things together. So we see a lot of what we call Frankenstacks in the go-to-market kind of operating model today. And, you know, Common Room, as a platform, this is very much the types of problems that we're seeking to solve through technology. And there's a lot of, you know, great stuff happening in go-to-market tech. I always like to say we're in the golden era right now, where you have this confluence of, you know, I think consumer behaviors have changed. Technology has come such a long way around, you know, those core things we care about, like identity and engagement signals and intent. And, you know, I think everyone's kind of looking at what can we achieve with AI or what AI can tell us that we don't already know. Well, let's talk about tools and technology for a second, because I think it's one of the ways that we can think about, you know, helping a field team ramp faster or execute more efficiently or deliver, most importantly, a more personalized and timely customer experience. So what are some of the tools that, you know, you are loving right now? How do you think about adopting tooling, knowing that the history of red tech is littered with, you know, software that doesn't end up being used by the reps, right? I think these are all themes we hear about a lot. So what's your philosophy there?
Yeah, you're right about if it's not used by the rep, it has no value. So I think there are a handful of things that I think about when we are going to invest in a new product or tool to support the team. One, is it unified? Can we embed it in our sales process? Is it exist today? Because if it is outside of our sales process, the likelihood of the teams using it is probably pretty low. The second is it easy? And this is actually really similar to HubSpot's value proposition, which I truly, truly believe in. If a tool is not easy for someone to use, they're not going to use it. Right?
Absolutely.
So they're going to opt into whatever they felt most comfortable with. And then will they see value pretty quickly? So for me, what we represent out to the market is the same requirements I use internally. When my team comes to me and they're excited about a tool and their friend at another company is using it, or they saw a demo, I'm like, how easy is it going to be for us to get everyone up to speed on this? How fast will we see value, and can we embed it in our tech stack in some capacity? And if the answer is no to one or more of those, then it's not going to be a go for the team, because I'm trying to minimize the tools we're using as opposed to adding more to it, creating more complexity. And I think that I'm not the only revenue leader doing that. You know, I like coined it the great rationalization a few years ago, where everyone said, gosh, like, we bought so many products in 2021. Now we have all of these tools in our tech stack. We're not really sure which ones bring value. There's overlapping features. Our reps have, you know, some teams have migrated to this tool, some prefer this, and it's created an inconsistency across the board, which has just made us more inefficient as opposed to what we were targeting over time.
Absolutely. And when you think about value, I'm guessing in today's kind of environment, and this is what we're seeing, it's really about that direct attribution to a metric that you care about, right, as part of that sales funnel.
Yes.
And have there been any tools recently that have kind of hit that value, you know, benchmark for you?
Yeah. So one of my teams is using a tool called Trumpet. I won't share the exact stats, but it's improved win rates, which is essentially a digital sales room. Our one team piloted it and saw immense success with it. And so for me, the benefit of that tool is that it's not just providing immense value for my sellers, but it's providing immense value for prospects and customers. So to me, that's like the win-win, when you can find something that is going to deliver both. I think I love products and tools. So I could talk all day about this. Some of these are for like Kimberly personally. When I went to Mexico City, I don't speak Spanish fluently. I'm taking lessons. I bought AirPods by a company called Time Kettle. They translate up to 70 languages, so I could interact in everything that we were doing. And so go back to the expanding the new markets. If your hesitation is that, you know, you're not bilingual and you're concerned about going into a market, you know, this would be an easier way for you to step in and feel more confident and comfortable about expanding. I love my Remarkable tablet. I referred it to every single person on my team. It's made me more organized, more effective, helps me communicate better. So if you haven't tried that, it's absolutely a blast. And then I talked about learning earlier. I think everyone has a recommendation, like, you should read this sales book, you should read this book, you know, you're going to love this. Read Extreme Ownership, read, you know, McChrystal's Team of Teams, read Move, like all these great books. It's hard to find time to consume that much content. And so all of my leaders, we all use the Headway app, which is micro learning. So it's condensing a standard size book to a 20-minute audio learning, which you can do while you're on a walk or folding laundry. And then we'll have discussions about the content. And so I think those who are going to find ways to continue to be successful are those who are evolving and willing to learn new things. And so even in a 20-minute book summary, it's helping us identify new ways of leaning into parts of our business that maybe we weren't getting that constant education around.
We know AI for go-to-market is one of the hottest topics out there. Everyone is coming to us saying, hey, I want to realize the promise of AI for sales. How do I do it? What is your perspective on it as a sales leader? What's HubSpot's perspective on it, you know, as an area where there's a lot of innovation happening?
So let me start with the personal answer first, because I think in order for people to get comfortable with AI, they have to use it in their real life and then their work life. Recently, my parents were visiting, you know, they're a little intimidated by AI. And I quickly showed my mom how she could take her grocery list and organize it through AI by which, row in the grocery store, right? And then I helped my dad with his football picks for the week by, you know, dropping in his selections into AI and summarizing the data points that he needed in order to make the best selections. He was ecstatic because the following week, you know, he won his normal football pool. So for me, I'm like, think about ways to incorporate in your normal day-to-day life. It won't seem that intimidating when you get to the work life, and advice I give for our sellers too. For us at HubSpot, you know, AI is embedded in so many of the things that we're doing. If you're not familiar with our new product spotlights, Breeze Intelligence is massive for us. But I'll talk more specifically about my sellers. So there are a handful of ways that we're driving, I'll say, improvement in our productivity through AI. So the first is, we mentioned earlier, top performers do research. So the ability for my sellers to do research before they jump into a prospect or customer call is number one. The second is call summaries. So call summaries help our sellers and managers minimize the time they're spending reviewing, we'll say, gong calls or just standard calls that the rep had, and identifying next steps, action items, and risk associated with that specific call. The third, which is a dream for forecasting, is we're using automation to look at the opportunity and automate deal stage progression. So for my sales strategy team, there it's no longer the day of like, are we sure we have this many deals sitting here? The automation is actually allowing us to know, based on the interaction that our sellers are having with that account, how quickly we can move it from phase one to phase two. All those things are amazing. I'll go back to something I said earlier, which is, if it's not embedded in your tech stack, it probably won't be adopted. So as you're thinking about how you're going to use AI to improve productivity and outcomes, I mean, this could be an hour-long conversation. I would say, like, the bare minimum is understand how it's embedded in your sales tools, process, and stack, and make it easy and fast for your sellers to use and get comfortable with, and they will see value. And for me, this is just the tip of the iceberg.
That's amazing. One debate we often hear as a follow-up is, hey, I want to use AI to make my best sellers better. Right? They're the ones who are already doing the research. They're able to construct these really incredible views around who they should prioritize. They're going into all the various point solutions to look at the data, right? They're doing something that other sellers are not doing. AI is going to make those folks even better at their jobs. And then we also hear, no, the main value of AI for sales is to lift the mean. It's to make, you know, your average rep even better, because now you're able to surface the signals that, you know, that really 1% rep is looking at and feed it to, you know, the rest of the field in a way that's easier or more automated. Or, you know, AI is going to be able to help reps ramp faster, help newer and career reps, you know, understand these complicated buyer committees and the complicated technology that everyone is trying to put into the hands of customers. What's your philosophy there? Is it both? If you could only pick one, which one would it be?
I truly believe that in order to drive real growth, you have to create equity in your organization, which means I would never provide tools for just one subsegment. The true value comes when everyone is receiving benefit from what you've invested in. And if you're about to invest in a tool that only helps a subset of your sellers, that's probably the wrong tool. right? Everyone should see value from the use of AI or really anything you're investing in. And so you're delaying your growth by saying, okay, we're just going to try the new people, and then we're going to try the mid-tier, then we're going to try the top performers. The lift in driving enablement for your entire sales organization, if you draw it out over years, is minimal. If you commit to this product and you say, this is what we're doing and everyone's getting it and we're enabling it at once, that's the lift. That's the opportunity. That's the growth driver. So for me, it's an all or nothing commitment. Like, we're not just going to provide it for our top sellers or our bottom people. We need to create equity for the entire sales organization and lift everyone at the same time.
Yeah. AI has a great, you know, delivery of accessibility and equitability. I think that's the most that we can absolutely hope for. Thank you so much for sharing your great gifts list. And Trumpet's an awesome customer of ours, and we're looking at leveraging that too. So really great shout out for a tool that's really moving the needle on those metrics. And I guess the last thing I'll say is, you know, I think there's been some really strong themes in this conversation around your North Stars as a leader, from continual learning and the importance of always learning to, you know, jumping into new gaps in the business that haven't been done before, and, you know, haven't been built before. And then I think the third piece is like the incredible things that organizations can achieve when the people are feeling motivated and inspired and aligned along, you know, the mission and the goal of delivering customer value. So, Kimberly, thank you so much for this conversation. I've learned a lot, and I know our audience will find all of this invaluable. So thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.